Accession number 18624, Reel 2.
Dickie Sweet, Reel 2. You were just saying about leaving themselves up.
Well, the Yangtze River is so vast. It's even at Hankow, it was about a mile and a half broad. And, of course, with all the snows and all that, it was a constant current of about 8 to 12 knots. And, of course, they had to push their way with these long poles, literally. In fact, we used to see when they used to put the poles to the shoulder to put their weight behind it, the poles had in effect made holes in their chests. And, daily, when they moored by the bows of the ship, to get out of the drag of the river, saw berths practically one a week, where they just the women would, the Chinese keep warm by putting these, we used to say, putting these blankets on. They just add these padded jackets to their until they, they got warm. Well, we've saw women stopping whatever chores they were doing on these on the decks of these junks, putting their clothing on the deck and just squatting down and exerting, and there's a child. And I said, for our way of living, it seems so primitive. But they'd break the umbilical cord, and clean the child up and just go about their duties. There were constant firing parties, marching men down to the mud flats, which we were more amongst, and execute people. It seemed all so strange. I mean, we were 17-year-olds, and here we were seeing poverty at its very worst. The beggars that used to come down to the ship were grotesque. You'd have people turning up at we had a sentry, obviously, at the approach to the ship, armed sentry, there'd be people coming down with feet instead of hands. Grotesque, a huge distortion of features. When the snows came and ice and everything was around, there'd be naked bodies crawling to the ship to try and beg for a crust of bread and things like that. I heard a person say, "Thank God I was born British," because it was so different, and of course, there at that time the mutiny hadn't started, and the Reds hadn't started to move down and occupy the country. It was Kai Chek who was still ruler of China at that time, the two main shipping lines on the Yangtze was Butterfield and Swire, and Jardine and Matheson. They were the two British, they had the ferries. And they imported and built cranes just about 100 yards up from our mooring to load and unload the ferries. But the coolies, no way. They just came down in vast numbers and tipped them in back into the river. You know, the cranes were denying them a living. So you learned a lot of what life was like and could be anchored up there in Hankow. To occupy the ship's company, the only work they could put the ship's company to, I mean, you couldn't do any drilling, etc., things like that. What they did was that HMS Cape Town, during its life, must have been, let's say, 10 or 12 years at sea, and every year they'd painted the ship's side. That was another coat of paint. So they put our ship's company to the task of giving you a little hammer to chip the paint off, right down to the bare metal, which wasn't very comfortable. I mean, it was winter and it was very cold and snow, and having to stay out in the cold wasn't very nice. Another snag which befell the Cape Town also was the only water you could get, could get drinking water shipped to be used for tea and things like that. But to scrub the decks or anything like that, you had to use the water from the river, which of course is dark brown with mud. So we used to have to fill great big panniers with water and allow it a couple of days for it to settle down, and then you had clean water for keeping the ship clean. We had the first winter, yes, we had a nice Christmas party on board the ship. Some of the British people that lived in Hankow, mainly banking people, or you know, that phase, came down and gave us some bits of food, you know, just for Christmas Day. But not very nice, the Yangtze.
So you spent 2 years in it and then went to Brazen?
No. The first year of 1934 to the summer of 1935, we were at Hankow. We then came down river when the waters rose sufficiently for us to go over the sand barrier. We then joined up with the fleet in 35 for exercises at Wee-Eye-Wee. Then in the September of 35, of course, the Italians invaded
Abyssinia.
So all the county-class cruisers were diverted to leave the China fleet and team up with the Mediterranean fleet. So we were then, for the second year, stationed in Shanghai itself, which was lovely. Oh, I love Shanghai. It was known in those days as the city of the world. The only snag was I was still only an ordinary seaman and not entitled to night leave, so I couldn't go down to the cabarets, etc. So I didn't gain very much out of it. But Shanghai being the city it was, there was a Union Jack Club where you could go ashore for a weekend and then sleep in a nice clean bed instead of a hammock. There were big cinemas there, and in fact I saw Fred Astaire's first film, dancing film, and when a year later I came home from China, it still hadn't reached UK yet, so that was an advantage. There was also a British club at Shanghai who allowed us to use their facilities, so Shanghai was much better. And I would like to go back to see Shanghai. It was a beautiful city.
Why did you come home in 1936?
That was the end of the commission. The Navy in those days had if you were on a foreign commission, usually you were away for 2 years. So 1936 in May, we set sail for UK to pay off, as they call it. And that's where I made my second biggest mistake in the Navy.
What was that?
Well, I was still only ordinary seaman. You didn't get made able seaman until you reached the age of 18. Well, I was still 17 and a half at that time. And I took it into my head that when we got our sailing orders to Homeward Bound, I thought, right, I'm going to have one night ashore, whatever, which I did. Came back aboard the ship the next day and appeared before Captain Budgeon, and he says they read out the charge, absent without leave from such and such a time, etc., etc. What have you got to say? And I said, well, sir, I said, after 2 years out here, I thought I'd just like to see what the nightlife was like in Shanghai. The penalty for that is that for every 3 hours you lose a day's pay and a day's leave. But not only that, he said, scale and pay, which is the reference to this day's pay for every 3 hours and leave. He then said, confined to the ship for 4 weeks. And we were homeward bound. So for 4 weeks, I was not allowed off that ship. So there's nothing I could do about it. I, in fact, had defied the Navy. And you pay the penalty. So anyway, all the way back down to Hong Kong, down to Singapore, Colombo, to what's the dump?
Aden.
I was confined to the ship, but there was a little break in it. When we arrived at Suez, suddenly we got diverted to go to a port, Jaffa, in Israel, to pick up the Emperor of Abyssinia and his retinue. They'd been turfed out of Abyssinia, and the ship was diverted to there to pick them all up. I was involved in this a bit because I was in charge at that time with the accommodation, officers of accommodation. And of course the officers had to double up because there were, amongst the retinue, there were of course the two princesses. Anyway, we then set sail to, we originally would have called in at Malta, but we didn't. We went direct with the royal party to Gib, where there was a P&O liner homeward bound. They were transferred to, and so they finished their journey to the UK in comfort. And that's the day that I was allowed off the ship. That was my 4 weeks.
What impression did the Abyssinian royal family make?
I don't wish to be rude to them. Again, aroma. Smelly. Mind you, they'd been turfed out of Abyssinia, and I suppose I don't know what accommodation they had in Jaffa, but everybody complained about the aroma, but you know, he's royalty.
So then did you go to Brazen?
No, I was allowed ashore at Gibraltar. Then, of course, the last lap was back to Plymouth. What a lovely feeling after 2 years it was to, with our paying off pennant streaming out behind us, of entering Plymouth Harbour. And then, of course, we all then were entitled to 4 weeks Foreign Service leave. So within a couple of days, I was back in Guernsey. And there for 4 weeks. When I came back from that 4 weeks holiday, I then received the draft chitty, as we called it, to HMS Brazen.
Where did you join that ship?
Plymouth Harbour.
What impression did the ship make on you after Cape Town?
Well, it was something new. Cape Town, you see, was a light cruiser, but I was now joining a destroyer. Now, when you think of a destroyer, you've got the greyhounds of the of ships. And the first thing I did was seek extra. I was prepared to do extra. Time steering the ship to get my certificate of which I've still got clearance for seamanship in boat ship handling, which you know, it was an art to become a helmsman, as your title was, because you had complete feel of the ship. You were also in charge of the telegraphs, etc., and so any change in orders down from the bridge, you were the one that executed it. And Commander Taylor was the captain when I got my certificate. And still got it, that I was qualified to helmsmanship.
Where did this ship sail when you were in it?
Well, the first journey was up to Rosyth for exercises. This was on the winter cruise. We called in at Scapa Flow, again doing exercises with other ships. Rosyth Dockyard was quite pleasant. The nearest place to go to, of course, was Edinburgh and Dunfermline. Then we came south for Christmas, and we had Christmas leave. And then for the spring cruise, which is started in January, we proceeded to the Mediterranean. And on the way down to the Mediterranean, our sister ship, HMS Basilisk, broke down in the Bay of Biscay. And we were diverted from the fleet to take her in tow, Well, I don't know if you've ever been through the Bay of Biscay, but even when it's in a good mood, there's always a very heavy swell. And when it really gets rough, you're in dire trouble. We managed to get the basilisk in tow, but then the tow line snapped, and we were left with half a cable of, which is about 30 foot of anchor chain hanging over our stern. And in the effort to try and get rid of this thing that was holding us down, we got hit by two very heavy seas, and the brazen really almost turned turtle. The rollometer, which is on the bridge, went to 75 degrees. How the ship recovered, I know not, but all the loose fittings on the deck of the brazen, including the lifeboat, were smashed and lost overboard. But the ship did right itself in a hell of a mess, and we managed to make it to Gibraltar, where, of course, we were then put back into repair. They did a good job repairing us. All the fittings were replaced. I wasn't at the helm on that particular part, so I hadn't got my certificate, I don't think, at that time for helmsmanship. Anyway,
which year is that?
This is
1936.
But then Franco decided to invade Spain, so we were down at Oran, which is a French port in French North Africa, and we'd been the guests of Sidi Bel Abbes, which was the headquarters of the French Foreign Legion, and they really did us proud. They gave us a real entertainment. We ran across a few Brits who were part of the Foreign Legion. As soon as you started to ask them any personal questions, there was a shutters down, you know. Anyway, in the middle of all this, we suddenly got a signal to proceed to Algeria to pick up refugees. And when we got to the port, there was a Ramillies, I think. There was a battleship there who was the refugees were all heading for, and the Ramillies would then transfer them to us, and we would then take all these refugees up to Marseille. Much to my horror, our captain at that time, which was a commander, was a bit of a. We had three. We of the lower deck had three species of officers. There was an officer and a gentleman. There would be an officer who would be very strict, and then you'd have what we called a naval pig. And these were the nasty ones, you know. You meet them in every walk of life, where they're objectionable, they treat everybody as dirt. This captain that we had on the brazen had made a mess of leaving Devonport when we commissioned. He left our aerials and masts dangling off the upper works of the aircraft carrier Argus. And then when we went alongside the Ramillies to pick up the refugees, the Ramillies class of battleship had big blisters on the sides for torpedo protection, and they project, away from the ship. And Taylor told the officer of the watch, you know, bear off forward. Well, pushing the bow out from the ship made the stern go in. And the next thing we knew, our propellers were churning chunks of metal out. So we then had a problem. We still had to go to Marseille, but it made the journey much worse because we didn't have balanced propellers. And the destroyers, you know, there are two propellers, twin. We had to sort of make do with the one good one. It was all put right once we got to Marseille. They put us in the dockyard and it was all put right. Well, we did two or three journeys. I felt very sorry for the refugees because a destroyer is not very spacious. We all gave up our own sleeping spots and, you know, tried to make these women and children comfortable on our sparse naval hammocks and blankets. They were sick as dogs, you know, because a destroyer doesn't remain very steady for long. Anyway, we did three trips, I think it was, to Marseille, and then we suddenly got diverted to go around the into the Atlantic and head for the place Rin Tin Tin mining place. I can't think of the
Rio name. Tinto.
Yeah, Rio Tinto. I can't only remember the name of the river.
In Spain?
Yeah.
The Guadalquivir?
Just up from Lisbon.
Tagus?
Yes. Yeah, no, Tagus is...
Is Portugal.
Is Portugal.
The Guadalquivir is the...
Yeah. Anyway, where the Rio Tinto mines are, and of course that was to protect the mining community because Franco's troops had reached that portion already, and they were doing a lot of training of recruits, and so they put the brazier in there for about a week we stayed there, ready for any, you know, trouble. We then got diverted to the north of Spain using memories. Santa Barbara, or
Saint-Jean-de-Luz.
Yeah, that was our anchorage. And we joined up then with the flotilla leader, HMS Kempenfeldt, and I think the other destroyer, there were three of us anyway, and we patrolled then the north coast of Spain because Franco's troops were making great advances, and we were patrolling, you know, to go to the rescue of any Brits that got in trouble, Santanga, all the whole course. In the middle of this, who shouldn't appear on the scene but the Grasse Bay, coming up to interfere. Now, at that time, there was a bloke, a Welshman, with the nickname of Potato Joe, who was running the gauntlet between England and Spain with potatoes for the beleaguered Spanish. So our flotilla leader strung all three of us north of the Spanish coast as a protection for Potato Joe to escort him and let him get his cargoes ashore. And when the Grasse Bay turned up, the flotilla leader made a signal, repeated to us, of course, what are your intentions? And the Grasse Bay answered, none. Just interested spectator.